From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In a 1989 New York Times obituary, Edward Abbey was described as a writer who liked to play poker with cowboys while continuing to ridicule the ranch owners who overgrazed the West's ravaged grasslands. By all accounts, Abbey was a hardscrabble, grizzled egalitarian, a larger-than-life writer who adored the desert and excoriated the industrial development that threatened the quiet wilderness. A major collection of Abbey's work is making its way to the University of Utah, and that's giving us an opportunity to explore Abbey's work and his influence on modern environmentalism. Today on the program, an Edward Abbey retrospective. Plus, rethinking the fax machine. A new art exhibit explores how the fax is being used in new ways. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Edward Abbey, the godfather of environmental monkey wrenchers, was not a Utahn by birth, but he spent much time in the state and set his most famous works here. So in many ways, it's fitting that a major collection of his work is coming to the University of Utah. Today on the program, we're talking about Edward Abbey's love of the desert and his legacy for the modern environmental movement. Joining me this hour, Ken Sanders. He's owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. And Ken, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also with us, Greg Thompson is the Associate Dean for Special Collections at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. Dr. Thompson, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
A public lecture and a reception marking the opening of the Abbey Collection will be held this Sunday afternoon. We'll give you more detail on that in a little bit. Also, later in the program, we turn to new uses for the fax machine, the artistic vision of the fax. But first, Edward Abbey. Have you read Hey Duke Lives or Desert Solitaire recently? Why do we continue to pore over Abbey's prose and his essays? If you have questions or comments about Edward Abbey and his work and his life, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ken Sanders, I want to start with you. You went river running with Edward Abbey. You shared a love of books. You were friends. How did you become acquainted with Edward Abbey?
Back in my old cosmic airplane days in the 1970s, Jennifer, it was about the time Monkey Wrench Gang was first published in 75, and I read it then, and we, of course, carried it. The paperback came out in 1976, and we carried it in the Cosmic. And Ed, at the time, in the early to mid-70s, was living in Moab, and he used to periodically come through Salt Lake and come to the bookstore. And I don't know that I'll ever live down my first encounter with the great man when I took him in the back room and lectured him on the bad habits of Hayduke and Company littering their beer cans on our highways.
Oh, how did he react to that?
Stoically and well. He was used to talking to fools before. But in spite of that beginning, we went on to do a lot of things together. You know, we brought him and Barry Lopez in as a fundraiser for the old Utah Wilderness Association. Later, he and Utah Phillips shared a stage at the old South High, and got involved in doing an Edward Abbey calendar publishing project for over a decade with Ed that he, again, went along with. That he wasn't sure what he thought of being a calendar boy, but he was happy to indulge others. And in person, he was just a very quiet, thoughtful, philosophical man. He kind of wrote a public persona for himself in his own books.
He was said to be quite a ladies' man, though. Married 5 times.
Yes, as Ed liked to put it, I never had more than 2 children with any one wife.
And he also, I mean, his writing reveals a deep love of nature, but also sort of this simmering contempt for ways to destroy that solitude.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at 20th century environmentalism, we've got, you know, going back, we've got giants like, John Muir in the olden days, and then Aldo Leopold and Robert Marshall's come along, and they really set up a philosophical background for wilderness, and the late Wallace Stegner, whom the university also has an extraordinary archive of, really got into contemporary wilderness issues, and the late Rachel Carson really brought the environmental dangers of mistreating our wilderness through the DDD, you know, bird egg exposure thing. But I think, and others have contributed other things over the decades, but beginning in the 1960s with the publication of Desert Solitaire, Edward Abbey really brought people into the landscape and celebrating, really, if you will, the hedonistic nature of wilderness for its own sake, not for any other. And he really took that further than any other writer, modern writer, had at that time. Mm.
Dr. Greg Thompson with the University of Utah, tell us a little bit about the collection that's coming to Utah. 176 pieces, I believe.
That is correct, Jennifer. It's a wonderful collection. It is a print collection, by and large. That means that it's novels, essays written by Ed Abbey. There are pieces written about Ed Abbey, excuse me. And there are a few audio and one or two video pieces in the collection that record Ed talking and giving presentations, as well as one documentary talking about his life and his contributions. Mm. In addition, there are a few what we call primary pieces in the business, and they are contracts between Ed and his publishers, as well as a small amount of correspondence in the collection. But primarily, the collection is a print collection. And the wonderful piece about it is that it represents virtually all first edition publications in many languages. I can't say it's all languages, but many languages. And it's many are presentation copies to the donor from Ed, and so they are autographed and they carry an extra information value for the user.
Well, why the University of Utah? Edward Abbey, of course, went to the University of New Mexico. He spent time at Stanford as a fellow. Why is the collection coming here, Greg Thompson?
We have a deep interest in collecting on the writers of the West, certainly of Utah and the West. And Ed he also wrote on Utah. But we're very interested in building collections that record the writing of the West and on the West by novelists, poets, biographers, and historians as well. And so this fits absolutely cornerstone piece direct into our collection on the West and the Western writer.
And Ken Sanders, excuse me, I believe you had a key role in bringing this to Salt Lake City.
Yeah, Eric's collection I'd known of for many, many years.
This is the collector Eric Vogel from California.
Correct. And he has amassed the most significant collection of Abbey works ever in private hands. We have to remember, he only wrote 21 books in his lifetime, so almost 200 pieces is a pretty thorough, in-depth look at his works. And Dr. Thompson forgot to mention, in addition to all the various first printings in various languages, it has later printings and off-prints. And Ed published enormously in magazines and periodicals ranging from Reader's Digest to the National Geographic. He wrote one book for Time Life Books, Cactus Country, and they were so enamored of him they invited him to do a new one on Mexico. And after they read his manuscript and what he had to say about immigration in the two countries, they fired him and never published it and never asked him to write for him again. There's even a wonderful Four Corners Geological Society annual publication, which represents all of the mineral extraction people and the oil companies in the States. And in 1975, prior to their knowledge of him publishing the Monkey Wrench Gang, they asked the famous Moab author of Desert Solitaire to write an introduction to their geologic mining periodical, which is probably the oddest contrast in bedfellows that Abbey ever did. Mm. He even wrote anonymous pieces under fake letters and pseudonyms, from letters to the editor to one men's magazine did a biography of him once that Ed actually wrote himself and had submitted under a false name.
He was a literary type, and
so I didn't answer your question at all.
That's okay. I'm used to that. We're speaking with Ken Sanders, owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Also with us, Greg Thompson, associate dean for special collections at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah, which is receiving a large collection of Edward Abbey publications. There is an event this weekend. We'll give you details on that a bit later. But if you have questions or comments about Edward Abbey and his influence on modern environmentalism, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. In Abbey's writing, he rhapsodizes about the primitive and remote places that he found in Utah's Red Rock country. What is it about Utah and the West generally that really captured his soul and his spirit?
After he got out of the Army in the late 40s, he hitchhiked from his home of Pennsylvania out west for the first time and fell in love with the entire West. And over various time periods, he spent the majority of his life living in either New Mexico, Arizona, or Utah. And he just never wanted to leave it. He saw it. You know, he was a seasonal ranger at then Arches National Monument and for a couple of parts of two seasons in the mid to late 1950s.
And I love how he describes it. It's a small, kind of remote national park out in the middle of nowhere. Now we think of Moab as Moab, you know.
Yes, the chain motel, chain restaurant, sure. Hellhole that it's become, despite the wonderfulness of its landscape and its citizens. One artifact, interestingly enough, I'll be bringing to the Sunday lecture will be the very tattered and misshapen folding chair that Ed used to sit on out by Balanced Rock in his trailer and wait for to greet tourists, in his words, as he put it, if any.
Hmm. I do think that there is this perception of him as a lone rider on the range, but... you know, he certainly spent time in the academy. He was a Fulbright scholar.
Yeah, he went to Oxford. Ed loved giving things away. He was not a collector like Eric and myself or Dr. Thompson, for that matter. He's a collector by profession, and he was always giving things away. He hated the weight of his belongings to weigh him down. He gave books away. Every time I ever saw the man, he was giving me books away, and half of them I wouldn't take. It's like, this is really weird academic philosophical crap, Ed. I'm not reading this stuff, man. Who would read this? It's just way too intellectual for me. He was a really deep thinker, and people that only think of him as the author of the Monkey Wrench Gang and perhaps dismiss him in a frivolous sort of manner are making a mistake and really should look at some of his other works. An essay in his last collection of essays, One Life at a Time, Please, an essay called The Writer's Credo, I believe is one of the best articulations of why a human being should write and stand up for what they believe in that any author of any time period has ever written. Mm. And it's virtually unknown and neglected.
We're speaking with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City and Greg Thompson with the Marriott Library at the University of Utah. We're talking about Edward Abbey, if you'd like to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones. Eloise is joining us from Salt Lake City. Eloise, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got a chuckle when Ken mentioned about the beer cans. When he was here, Ed Abbey was here one time for a book signing, my husband took our copy of the Monkey Wrench Gang down there and told him I was upset with him about how he'd written about tossing the beer cans out into our beautiful desert. And so he inscribed in the book, Eloise, sorry about the beer cans, Ed. So he must have heard that from more than one person.
Eloise, when was the last time that you read something from Edward Abbey?
Oh, it's been years, but, you know, he had spunk and he had a good way of presenting our beautiful environment here in Utah in his books. So I always appreciated him for that.
Eloise, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're talking about Edward Abbey. A new collection is coming to the University of Utah this weekend. A public lecture and a reception marking the opening of this collection will be held this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Ken Sanders will deliver the lecture, R. Crumb Meets the Monkey Wrench Gang, Edward Abbey and the Modern Environmental Movement from Earth First to Tim DeChristopher. That's happening in the Marriott Library at the University of Utah with a reception to follow at 4 o'clock. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Ken Sanders is with us, also Greg Thompson from the Marriott Library. We're talking about Edward Abbey, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and today on the program, we're talking about Edward Abbey, his love of the desert, and his legacy for the modern environmental movement. Joining me this hour, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Also with us, Greg Thompson, Associate Dean for Special Collections at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. The reason why we're talking about Edward Abbey, not that we need a reason, but a major collection of his work is coming to the Marriott Library. An event, a public lecture, and a reception will be held this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Marriott. We'll give you details on that a bit later. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Edward Abbey, best known for his novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, his collection of essays, Desert Solitaire. Over a million copies of each have been sold. Ken Sanders, you have a hard time keeping them stocked in your bookstore.
It's been 22 years since Ed left us, Jennifer, and I'm constantly amazed and pleased with young people continuing every generation. I mean, the traditional student body at our universities, as we speak, wasn't yet born on the planet when Ed Abbey died. They've been born in a whole generation, literally, since then. But yet, they're finding his works. He's being taught in university and academic settings, which would highly amuse Ed, mind you. His academic setting of choice was involved a lot of sand and slick rock and cactus. But it's just astonishing how people relate to him and still reading, and that's to me a mark of literature, that it lives. Will Edward Abbey live for another 100 years? Well, I can't say. I won't be around to know. But I like to think so, and I do believe so.
Dr. Thompson, why do you think Ed Abbey's work continues to resonate with people?
Well, for one reason, he was an excellent writer, and as Ken was pointing out, he's a very thoughtful, probably a brilliant individual, camouflaged it a bit, I think. But also, there has been, certainly in our part of the of the world, this ongoing deep interest in the environment, and he speaks to those that are interested in the environment. Sometimes he speaks a little different way with the Monkey Wrench Gang.
With a monkey wrench in hand.
Sure. Yeah, with a monkey wrench in hand, right, Ken? And I think that the younger person, that student that Ken was making reference to, is still seeking, looking, trying to figure out how does modern society interact with its environment? What does Ed Abbey have to say to them?
Mm. Ken Sanders, walk us through the kind of influence that you see Abbey having on the environmental movement. Your lecture, of course, from Earth First to Tim DeChristopher.
Well, you know, Ed really, you know, in the tumultuous 1960s, Ed published a quiet, thoughtful little book of meditation and contemplation, really, called Desert Solitaire, A Season in the Wilderness. And a decade later, he published the rather over-the-top Monkey Wrench Gang that he's so well known for. But he has a way of speaking with, in his fiction or his nonfiction, about his own exploits and foibles in a manner that most authors can't do, that he rises above himself and he uses himself as a character. And so it doesn't, he's not the cloying kind of author that's just sitting on your shoulder the whole time you're reading him, patting himself on your shoulder, telling you how clever he is. And that kind of author always annoys me, you know. Mm-hmm. And Ed could transcend that, and just, he could speak for all of us. And the themes he just honed and developed over the years, in a way that I think few others do.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, I mean, the Monkey Wrench Gang in many ways is kind of comic, but it seems like a lot of the passages have been taken very literally.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the 70s, after the 1975 publication of that book, it spawned a then radical environmental group called Earth First, always with the exclamation point, which went on. I first actually met them through Ed. I was harassing him to do the calendar at the time, in around 1980, and I had learned to never call Abbey on the telephone because he hated the damn things and didn't like talking on them. And if you called him up, it was like having a Zen conversation that you had to do all the talking because Ed wouldn't. So you better have something to say.
When you say the calendar, what do you mean?
Well, for 10 years I did the Edward Abbey Western Wilderness calendar, mm. and Ed indulged me in publishing that. So Ed calls me up one day and says, Ken, this is Ed. Want to talk about that silly calendar of yours, come down to Lone Rock Campground, and down on Lake Powell, for some kind of spring rites, he said. So I drove in my old 54 Chev pickup truck a few days early down to Lone Rock Campground, a barren sandstone waste by Lake Fowl, and these guys in a Volkswagen bus with a big black thing dripping off the top of it, looking like really hard-ass, redneck, long-haired cowboys, barricaded the road and had their hands across their chests and were scowling at me as I bumped up the road. And they immediately, you know, who are you? What are you doing here? And it's like, well, I didn't really care for their bedside manner. So the last thing I was going to tell these yahoos is Ed Abbey sent me. No way. I backed off, pulled around him and camped, and we had a pretty tense standoff until later that evening when Cactus Ed himself showed up, and then these boys and one girl gleefully informed me, once they found out I was a pal at Ed Abbey's, they couldn't wait to tell me of their plans to drop a 300-foot plastic crack down the face of Glen Canyon Dam early the next morning.
Wow.
And that was the birth of Earth First.
Wow. I had no idea you were on the ground at that moment.
I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations is passed. I hope.
Do you think that Edward Abbey had any influence on the modern crusader, Tim DeChristopher?
Absolutely, and I hope to be able to talk about that because, Ed Abbey in a comedic way, really advocated a lot of civil disobedience and even violence directed against things, not people. For Ed, there was a huge difference. And you know, we need to remember that bulldozers aren't sentient beings. They're not evil or good in and of themselves. It's what is being done. You know, all roads aren't bad. All mining isn't bad. All oil exploration. We all need and use these things. That isn't the point. The point is at what's the trade-off? What's the environmental cost? And where and when should we go in? And what do we take? And what's our trade-off? And as Wallace Stegner so eloquently put it in his Wilderness letter, we need wild places and wild things, whether we ever set foot in them or not. And Ed was certainly a passionate believer of that. But as I like to argue with him these many years after his death, you know, well, Ed, you know, maybe monkey wrenching isn't going to get the job done anymore. Maybe, you know, sabotaging bulldozers and spiking trees and general monkey wrenching and burning down billboards, it just ain't going to cut it anymore because the stakes are so much higher. And I think that Tim DeChristopher's actions at the BLM hearing, leases a couple of years ago, which he is now imprisoned in a federal penitentiary for, and this whole new movement, whether you want to call it the peaceful uprising movement that's come up around Tim DeChristopher and his actions, and or this whole 99% Occupy movement that's coming up, people are trying to figure out new ways to articulate protest in nonviolent civil disobedient ways against wrongs that they perceive in society. And I support them fully, and I think that they have been inspired a lot by Edward Abbey, and I think that it's a should be a criminal matter that Tim DeChristopher, for disobeying BLM rules and doing false bids on oil and gas leases in and around Arches and Canyonlands, is currently sitting in a two-year federal prison sentence, and people like the Garfield County officials that illegally pulled up BLM stakes and dumped them at the BLM office, and Representative Mike Knoll, who deliberately led an illegal ORV VVAT rally into closed BLM lands, never even got cited, never got a ticket, never went before a judge, D. Benson or not, and they're all still walking around, and Tim DeChristopher is in prison, and I think that's a shame. I think it reflects poorly on our legal system and exposes it for the stacked fraudulent system it is.
That's certainly a topic for another day, but yes, the sentiment, I think, it probably can find its roots in Edward Abbey's writings. We're speaking with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Also, Greg Thompson, Associate Dean for Special Collections at the Marriott Library at the University of Utah. Dr. Thompson, you're getting this large volume of pieces by Edward Abbey, first editions. What does it mean in the academic sense? I mean, how much value is there for future scholars of Edward Abbey to have this in their proximity?
There's tremendous value, and the value comes because two people very knowledgeable on Ed Abbey have assembled a collection. Ken was very instrumental in helping Eric to build his own private collection, and Eric, of course, had the interest and the passion to do it, and did it over three decades, I guess, Ken, about.
Yeah, you bet.
And so you get, first and foremost, you get a collection that is built by people who understand and who care and who have an intelligence about the author. So gathering that, having it available in multiple editions, with dust covers, with illustration by internationally known illustrators, all of this provides value to the scholar, to the student, to the professor who are interested in studying, teaching, and writing on Western literature and Western history.
How important were the illustrations to the book? I mean, they really complemented these publications, Dr. Thompson.
Well, I'll just say, and then I'm going to turn this to Ken, but I think they're very important. And
we're talking R. Crubb. I mean,
yes, Yeah, that's the international part
sure,
here.
Sure, yes.
Because it plants in people's minds an image. And I think if you were to ask the public, give us your sense of Ed Abbey, it would be one of those illustrations, probably a crumb illustrations. They are very important. They add tremendously. It's part of our art body of work on the West. Ken?
Well, and it's not just our crumb, Jennifer. You know, the seasonal park ranger, former seasonal park ranger Jim Stiles of Moab, followed Red Desert Solitaire and followed Ed Abbey from his own home in Kentucky out here and became a seasonal park ranger at Arches, following in Ed Abbey's footsteps, there's a Freudian slip for you, and then went on to illustrate The Journey Home in 1977 and his iconic collapsing of Glen Canyon Dam on the cover of that book. And Desert Solitaire has a dust jacket art and beautiful interior illustrations by the famed children's illustrator Peter Parnell. In the 1980s, when I got permission from Ed to do a 10th anniversary edition of the Monkey Wrench Gang in hardbound because it was out of print, and Ed and his, you know, naivety with publishing matters, which he was horrible with, I couldn't find out who owned the rights because Lippincott didn't exist anymore, and Avon, the paperback publisher, just kind of said, go away, kid. And Ed said, Ken, just go ahead and publish the book. I won't tell. So I first tried to get Crumb to do it. I'd known him a little bit peripherally from the old days, and so I wrote him. He was still here in this country in those days, and he turned me down cold. And I spent 2 years of agony and wasted money trying out illustrators that I could just see the whole, they didn't work. I could just see in my mind's eye. No other book by Abbey other than the Monkey Wrench Gang would work, but it was a perfect vehicle. The exaggerated nature of the comedic prose in that novel just begged for our Crumb caricatures. So finally, after 2 years, I sent Robert Crumb a paperback copy of The Monkey Wrench Gang, and once it never had occurred to me that someone like R. Crumb, a very, you know, urban kind of fellow, he had never ever heard of Edward Abbey or the book. Once he read it, he started calling me, and he'd say things like, well, and he's actually in person, Mr. Crumb is a very formal person. He would say, well, these characters in Mr. Abbey's novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, are there people in real life that go out and emulate that sort of behavior? And I'd say, yes, Mr. Crumb, there are, and they do. And then Wild Horses couldn't keep him away from that book. He really enjoyed doing it at the time. And one thing that still haunts me, briefly, I'll tell one very short anecdote. When we had Ed and Robert out here for a series of autograph parties, including one at the University Bookstore, the old Cosmic Airplane, and then the big publication party at Ken Slight's bookstore in Moab, Utah, when Abbey and Crumb met for the first time, Mutt and Jeff, and as we're taking Robert around, showing him the sights, he was just entranced with the old Indian art and rock art and things. He said, gee, if I'd seen this country first, I would have drawn those pictures completely different.
We're speaking with Ken Sanders, also with Greg Thompson from the Marriott Library at the University. Our time is short, gentlemen, but I guess I want to pose this observation to you. Larry McMurtry, in a review of Desert Solitaire for the Washington Post, wrote that Edward Abbey is the Thoreau of the American West. Would you agree with that statement, Dr. Thompson?
That's quite a statement. I would say that he certainly holds part of that mantle for the West.
Mm-hmm. Ken Sanders, what do you think? And would Edward Abbey agree with that statement?
No, Ed actually was quite insulted by the comment and resented it, despite, you know, McMurtry and Abbey knew one another. In fact, his widow, Clark, once, I think, was reading a copy of Lonesome Dove in an airport that McMurtry had signed to Abbey and somehow left it in the airport. And years later, it got back to her. Someone seized upon it at the airport. And they were friends, but Ed he really didn't like being pigeonholed like that and resented the remark. And famously, they printed it on the cover of one of the collections. I can't remember, maybe Down the River, but don't quote me on that. One with a blue dust jacket. And they misspelled McMurtry's name on the front cover of the book.
Probably couldn't make him any happier. What do you think he would make of his reputation today?
That's a really good question. And, you know, when Ed Abbey was alive, he most certainly didn't need anybody to speak for him. And I don't really want to put myself in that position now, even though I guess I have been of late. At first, it was way too painful to talk about Ed when he first was gone. But over the years, all these people have come out of the woodwork that kind of put their arm around Ed's mighty shoulders and, oh, Edward Abbey was my best friend. And I just don't want to be in that category, as he most certainly didn't need anybody to speak for him when he was alive. And if you want to know who the real Edward Abbey was or what he thought and thinks, he is still alive in the pages of those 21 books, and especially read the introductions to the books. Ed Abbey lives.
Ken Sanders, owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Greg Thompson, Associate Dean for Special Collections at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. Dr. Thompson, thanks to you.
You're welcome, and thank you.
A public lecture and a reception marking the opening of the Abbey Collection will be held this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Ken Sanders will deliver the lecture, R. Crum Meets the Monkey Wrench Gang, Edward Abbey and the Modern Environmental Movement, from Earth First to Tim DeChristopher. That will be happening in the library at the University of Utah. A reception will follow at 4 o'clock. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we have just the facts, as in fax machine, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Once a mainstay of the modern office, the fax machine has largely disappeared from the workplace. But now hundreds of artists, scientists, filmmakers, and writers are repackaging the fax machine as a tool to draw and to create. The machine is the focus of a traveling art exhibit that opens in Utah tomorrow. And joining me now to talk about fax is Aaron Moulton. He is senior curator of exhibitions at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And Aaron, thanks very much for your time today. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Fax opens tomorrow. That's March 2nd at UMOCA. 20 Southwest Temple. We'll give you more details on that in a bit. But first, fax. Do you still use a fax machine? And if so, why? If you have questions about fax the exhibition, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Aaron Moulton, before we get to the exhibit, and I guess I'd like to learn a little bit more about you. You've been in Utah for a whopping 7 weeks. You have a curatorial degree from the Royal College of Art in London. You've worked in Milan. You've most recently been a curator in Berlin. So I guess the question everyone wants to know answered is, why come to UMOCA? What was the attraction of Utah for you?
I think it's a natural conclusion, really. I spent the last 15 years living in major metropolises, focusing mainly on places that had pretty well-developed art worlds. So I lived in New York and London and Milan and Venice and in Berlin. And, you know, getting a sense of how art worlds work, getting a kind of a sense of that kind of learning curve, which is a pretty high-speed situation, very concentrated with artists and activities. And so ultimately, my goal was to somehow bring everything, that energy, to a place that where maybe there wasn't a well-developed arts infrastructure, and that could, you know, I think the biggest problem when you're in a city, when in a well-developed art world infrastructure, is you're in this kind of drop in the bucket, tree falling in the woods syndrome. You know, you're only as good as your next thing. You can't ever rest on your laurels with anything that you do. So you always have to be working to grow and maintain and keep and get your audience to come back. And so here, I mean, there's only a few institutions operating with goals towards contemporary art. And And I think you can really feel the very palpable potentials for impact in what your efforts are going to have on a public and a public's perception of the relevance of contemporary art in their everyday life. And I have no connection to Salt Lake City, actually, or Utah, but I'm a very adaptable person. And so it kind of, and I like living in the mountains all of a sudden, and being in a city in the mountains, it's kind of a nice anomaly, I think, so.
Is Vex your first exhibit?
Well, you know, I'm like the handmaiden of this exhibit. It's not my exhibit, so to speak. The interesting thing about Fax is that it comes from the Independent Curators International. It's originally curated by a guy named Joao Ribas, who's the curator of the Vera List Center at MIT in Boston. And basically, the ICI, the Independent Curators International, farms out exhibitions to institutions. They sell the idea, kind of like an extra value meal. You know, you get for this much dimensions and this much space and time, you can get a show. And Fax is, in a way, the best of what they can offer, because it's like it's like a Just Add Water exhibition, you know, where it's looking at the fax machine as a teleportational device to put an exhibition at the ends of the earth, you know. And so here it is now at UMOCA, where we must be the 14th venue that's hosted this exhibition. And the interesting thing is that the first venue was the Drawing Center in New York in June of 2009. It had maybe 80, 90 artists in it. And then every venue afterwards was able to add 10 to 20 artists and as many projects as they wanted within that kind of roster. And so the project just grows and grows and grows, and it's like it's a self-oiling machine at a certain point. And so we'll have an operating fax machine in the gallery that people will get to see the magic of the transmission coming in, and artists will be sending things in over time. The show's up for 2.5-3 months.
So what is the conceit of the exhibition? What is the idea behind it? You've got this fax machine.
You've got this fax machine. That's that. I mean, what is the fax machine? It is a teleportational device. It's the beginnings of the internet. It's like, you know, it sits in a nice line of, you know, how far we've come with communication. And hey, let's look at it as even a drawing device. I mean, look at the quality of the material that comes out of a fax machine. It's grainy. It's terrible. It's black and white. It's kind of awesome. I mean, you know, it's like the early pixel is there in the fax machine. It's just the analog pixel almost. And so you're able to see the various ways in which people are entertaining the notion of the fax machine, from just looking at very basic ideas of communication, you know, cans on a string, to the philosophies of, you know, information floating in the ether, to creating your own language with this very special device. And also embracing the failure of this device, you know, its obsolescence, and also what it gets wrong, which ultimately becomes what it gets right in this exhibition. It's like everything that goes wrong with what we hate about the fax machine goes right in this show, because artistic intent is so flexibly kind of accommodating in that way.
The images, you know, they're off-center. They can be distorted. They're horrible.
Well, they got these nice little headings at the top that give you kind of time, place, you know, back to the future kind of dates and coordinates. And I mean, it's a rubbish medium, you know. But I think, actually, in the end, this exhibition really gives it a legacy that it maybe wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, it would just be one of those things we laugh at with the 8-track or something. And suddenly, you know, come to UMOCA and you'll see something really special that's the power of this device and the magic of this device. And what we've done, you know, is we've got the most complete and comprehensive version of this exhibition, you know, nearly 500 artists, around 1,000 artworks. The place is packed with fax.
That's F-A-X.
F-A-X. And the way that, you know, and for our iteration, we've added, you know, only 10 artists, but the way that the artists are using the project is fantastic. We have this guy named Mike Boucher, who's based in Frankfurt, Germany, who, you know, I love Mike because he, like, L-U-V, because he's the guy who's, like, making these impossible artworks that really test our idea, our limits of what we're willing to accept as artworks. And so he's given, and also, you know, dealing especially with issues of production and outsourcing. And so what he's done is asked us to hire fax spam services. You know, these companies that where you get junk faxes from, and asked us to hire them and send 1 million faxes to English-speaking countries with an Arthur Schopenhauer quote that says something to the effects of, "In order to understand what is true, you need to know what is untrue." That's not an exact quote, but imagine receiving that fax anonymously, you know, in your office in the morning, and imagine a million people are getting this weird, you know, transmission about the, you know, the truth of the ether.
That is art. Aaron Moulton, he is senior curator of exhibitions at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. The exhibit Facts opens tomorrow, that's March 2nd, at UMOCA here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Aaron, you mentioned that there are hundreds of artists involved in this project so far. It's been traveling for 3 years now. Are the artists creating new work with the facts in mind, like the one that you mentioned, you know, transmitting a quote to a million different people, or are they taking existing pieces, three-dimensional pieces, and somehow transforming that into the fax transmission?
Primarily, it's all new work. I mean, the curator asked the artist to look at the fax as a medium and to see how their work could translate within it. And basically, everyone's made a new work. I thought it was initially, you know, it's for us. It's an honor and a pleasure to be able to host all these artists. We're looking at a roster of, you know, some of the top artists working today out of New York, out of L.A., out of New Zealand. You name it. This thing has been to the ends of the earth and grown in every location. And so we're looking at really a top roster of, you know, we could say an index of what contemporary art today is. What I originally thought was a pity about that was thinking, well, these are not the most representative works, maybe, you know, to give people an idea of, oh, what Dan Graham or Rem Koolhaas or Yona Friedman, what these people are actually doing. But that's not true. The more you look at it, the more you realize they have made very unique translations of their practice through the facts. So it's not just some, you know, kind of flippant or casual, you know, oh, whatever, here's a receipt. Actually, somebody did do that. you know, ultimately, you do find that this is a very incredible sort of translation of contemporary art today through what we could really honestly say is the top sort of 500 artists in, you know, operating in contemporary art. So, I think it offers a really special possibility. To answer your question, we do have objects, so to speak, that are translated through the facts, architectural interventions, things that deal with the results spatially. I've even had an artist send a full-size 5-foot by 4-foot painting that we now have in the space that we've had to create for him. And, ultimately you do have hopefully something that, you know, continues to test the notion of what is art. For the most part, it is just faxes, though. You know, I think that's the funny thing coming into it is that, you know, people expect kind of precious objects in art context. And that's not to say these aren't precious. The ideas are very much, you know, vibrating throughout, but they're just taking a form that's unexpected.
Mm. Fax opens tomorrow. You have another exhibit opening tomorrow as well, Onomatopoeia. Now, the title, of course, represents words that represent sounds like oink and arf. Describe what this exhibit is like.
It's actually the title of the exhibit for the artist Constant Dullart. So that's Dullaart, not dull art. But and he's a Dutch artist, and he's a really interesting guy who's working in this kind of what we could call analogital space, you know, the space between analog and digital. And in this way, he's a very perfect pairing to put alongside facts. And Constant's work, I mean, it really is that, you know, it's testing the sort of existential and philosophical domains that exist in, you know, when you're kind of waiting in standby for that YouTube video to load up, or you know, we have a piece where, if you remember your DVD player, when you plug it in and you don't have a DVD, and there's this little icon that kind of bobs around the screen. And what he's done is he's created that icon out of paper, and he's sitting there aware of the limits of the screen, and he's just bouncing this icon around to give you a sense that he's actually performing this really banal action. So he really antagonizes the kind of banalities that we take for granted within how technology takes us for granted.
I guess in some ways, this is both of these exhibits illustrate just how infused our culture is and what artists are thinking about when we think about technology and its influence in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's it's looking at it as a vehicle, a kind of existential vehicle in all senses. And I think the onomatopoeia, you know, to give some sense to it, I think we could, you know, while it's sounds that, you know, that emulate words or words that emulate sounds, I think it's about form following function, and somehow form emulating a function. So, and I think that's what Constant is doing, is investigating the innate sort of behavioral or performative kind of functions of how these forms, permeate our lives. And
Aaron Moulton, he's senior curator of exhibitions at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. We're talking about the two exhibits that open tomorrow, Facts and Onomatopoeia. They open tomorrow, March 2nd, at UMOCA, 20 Southwest Temple in Salt Lake City, as part of their First Friday celebration. You can find out more information on our website, kcpw.org. And Aaron Moulton, thanks very much for your time today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City, thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org or follow us on Facebook and Twitter at CityViewsSLC. Next time, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope that you'll join us for that conversation tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.